I think I'd love to just educate people on kind of this convergence between nature-based economy and artificial intelligence. I believe I came from the dot-com era where we had to hold every Thursday night education seminars on the internet, what it was and how to get on it and why you should get on it. And I feel like we're in that education phase in the impact space now. I feel like AI and impact is like internet time frame, but like, you know, nuclear mode.
Welcome to Green Planet, Blue Planet podcast. I'm here today with Jeremy McCain. Welcome, Jeremy. Welcome back.
And thanks. I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to continue the discussion.
Yeah, I love the continued dialogue with my guests and, you know, seeing over years what actually gets accomplished and the things we pull through on and the things we make real, right? Because it's all about that. Like, how can we build a healthy planet together? And, you know, you are very much on Team Ocean. And, you know, we were just, before we hit record on this, talking about, you know, your latest creation, Ocean Currency Network, and, you know, the idea of like how to bring a nature-based economy together and kind of marry that with the incoming reality of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this particular moment in time is a very interesting moment, right? Because it's like, you know, in some ways, there's like this entertainment value of AI that I think a lot of us have found interest in. But then we also know that, like, well, should we be nice to it? Like, is it going to attack us? Like, there's that side of it. And then, you know, on the climate side, there's like, well, are we in trouble? Like, are we done for? Right. And you, depending on who you talk to, they're like, oh, it's too far. We've already made the mistakes. And then you have some eternal optimists. And maybe I'm one of those people. It says, you know, we fixed the hole in the ozone layer. I'm like, give me a break. Like, surely we can tackle this. I think it's those kind of can-do attitudes I subscribe to more, because I feel like that's who we all are. As you know, as I mean, I would say, like, you know, if you're from the United States, what's beat in your head as you grow up is like, you can do anything you want to do. Well, you can if you apply yourself. Nobody's ever going to hand it out to you for free. So I think this is an interesting point in time, and I felt like, you know, this is a really good opportunity for us to start a concept like this, even though it is a little fringe by some respects.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot to unpack with artificial intelligence and the way that it can help us in the kind of climate dialogue or in the understanding of how to actually build a nature-based economy, right? Because most people, this is me, you know, projecting and making an assumption, but I think most people, when they hear AI, it's somewhere between what you said at the beginning, like, you know, entertainment based.
Right.
How can this enthuse me? And like, did you try ChatGPT yet? And is it writing your emails too? Haha, right? Like, that's a great gimmick. But really, I don't think that's like the essence of what this is really about.
No.
I think it's way beyond us having to kind of move on from writing our own emails. And then also the other kind of side of that spectrum, one is entertainment, the other one would be doomsday. Like, what if AI becomes a robotized army and it's going to attack everyone? And while I understand those conversations and those worries, especially if you've watched too much Hollywood in your lifetime, you know, it seems to me like we're really missing the point of the actual progress and what becomes possible. And then also that we are the creators of the AI. So therefore we also can set the limits to where, you know, and I know some people think we'll just get beyond those limits, but I believe we can set the limits to where AI is actually useful and where we just don't need it.
Yeah, I mean, so you bring up an interesting point about Hollywood, right? I like sharks. I like to swim with sharks, but I didn't always like to swim with sharks. I was afraid of sharks. I was petrified of sharks. There was a movie I watched called Jaws. I'm sure you've heard of it. And that put crazy fears into my head that I had to somehow get over. Another one was called Arachnophobia. I wasn't afraid of spiders. Then I saw that movie and it freaked me out.
Because they were like 60,000 times.
And they were like, really, yeah, and they were eating people and it was just gory. And so, of course, as a kid, these are the things that kind of get put into your mind. I think that if there was a movie about the internet or about microcomputers in the 1970s and how microcomputers were going to I don't know, do something horrible, people would have been equally as afraid of the doomsday of, oh my God, don't put an IBM on my desktop because X will happen. So I think that's also quite interesting too, because I think as our, in our most basic of natures, you know, all humans are storytellers. Like, we love a good story, right? And this is also the same reason why we like to tell bad news, or we like to gossip, is because, well, it's better that way. If I talk about all the good things, well, it's somehow not as sticky as the bad stuff. And so while I do see inherent threats with AI, I saw similar threats with the internet, with connectivity. I mean, one could argue the same thing for social media. I remember the first time that Twitter was used to overthrow a government in Egypt, you know, or used as to organize. So there are always negative consequences to all human inventions. But I think that if we let ourselves get carried away with that, that's where the real trouble is.
Yeah, big time. Because you could have the same fear thinking about, I don't know, a knife, right? Like, it can, you can use it to break bread and, you know, put butter on your bread, or if you don't like butter, something else, you know, or right. Or you could kill someone with a knife. And so obviously right. We're not banning all knives, but it's more about how do we become responsible stewards of the tools we've created. And, you know, to a degree, like, we evolve with every tool. I think with social media, probably we haven't quite evolved yet to the place where we really understand. Yeah. I think a lot of people understand the havoc it has created in our consciousness, but we haven't really matured yet to the degree where we're like, okay, we will collectively go onto, you know, like a cleanup of social media and only create the ones that create positive dopamine loops and, you know, and endorse, you know, something that creates, you know, an actual positive output. But I think with AI, we'll have to get to this point of, you know, how does it actually serve us to evolve our systems, to evolve our economy, and to understand nature, because nature in its complexity is just data points, right? Like, it's a whole lot of beauty, and I usually hang out there when I think of nature, but also it's a whole lot of data points. And I don't think anyone human can understand them without some help of either an advanced, you know, kind of indigenous level intuition, or a form of, you know, artificial intelligence that could make that visible to us. And I know that's kind of part of what you're working on with the ocean.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I think we should also, you know, for the audience, break it down a little bit too, from the standpoint of, let's, you know, when the microcomputer came to us, it was like, first of all, it's going to revolutionize things. They said, you're going to spend less time at work because you have a computer on your desk. It's going to do most of the work for you, and you'll have extra days that you can spend with your family. And that might have been true. I wasn't around for that in the very beginning, but mostly it wasn't, because we saw a new tool on the desk that we had never seen before. We saw how it could change the way that we calculate things, bring in the spreadsheet, right? How we were able to really do things that were, it took ages to do before. And now we could do 5 spreadsheets or calculations, you know, that we wouldn't have only been able to do 1 before. I think the same thing's going to happen with AI. You jokingly mentioned write your emails, but you know what? I'll tell you that a guy with dyslexia, you know, it's a problem sometimes writing an email. Sometimes I type the word a lot and I put allot, not a space lot. There's just certain things that I just can't seem to break, and AI does help me with that. And the thing is that we will ultimately get to a spot where we say, gosh, you know, we've got to hurry up and get to a certain point. And kind of the nice segue to all of this is, it's like, well, we know we have a limited time to really make the changes necessary in regards to climate change, but there's a lot of things that we don't measure. And what we do measure, it takes ages to report and identify. But what if we could take billions and billions of measurements every single day? And we could ask our computer friends and say, hey, can you make sense of this based off of this other data set that I've asked you to reach millions and millions of pages of? And could you tell me really quickly what it all means? Give me the lowdown. You know, I mean, if you think about the president walks into the office, he's got all of his cabinet members, they're all sitting there, and they've done copious amounts of studies on all the things that they've got to worry about as leaders of a government. And the president doesn't say, okay, I'm going to start with you. You read everything that you've been reading to me right now, and then we'll just go around the room. He'd be there forever. There's a reason why we have these kinds of resources. Give me the top level. What are the things I need to worry about right now? And what direction should we go towards? And so now you have this. So I really want people to think of artificial intelligence as their own personal cabinet, right? So that they can actually be the president of whatever it is that they're working on. It also gives people the opportunity to be able to use this information as power to push the needle, right? For the first time, people who haven't had the capability to drive real impact now have the tools to do so. And so that's one of the things that we're hoping to kind of solve at the Ocean Currency Network.
Right. And acquire the data that we actually need to make healthy planetary decisions, right? Especially in regards to the ocean.
Right. Yeah. And do it in record timing. I mean, just to give you an idea, like one of the things that we're working on now is we're taking, papers from scientists that have all this peer-reviewed studies of all these amazing understandings of the ocean. You know, what is the acceptable level for salinity? What is the acceptable level of turbidity and all these other kinds of things that we measure water quality? I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I tell everybody I'm a last mile scientist, right? I work with scientists to figure out how to get it into the hands of the masses. That's what we need. And so great. Awesome. I see what they've published, but now we've got copious amounts of data. What if we could use artificial intelligence to ingest that data against those peer-reviewed papers? Now what we've done, we said, okay, based off of all of this, this is the overall status of things, and here's what you got to look out for. And so that's what we built. We built a platform that does that, and every 60 minutes you get a report that gives you an overarching report on exactly what's happening in your waters. And so I think this is important because it allows you to make decisions, especially when something pops up as an anomaly. It allows you to make the decisions necessary before it becomes the next major catastrophe.
And so you've started with those sensors, right? Like I think you told me Caribbean islands, that's kind of where you started to put the first sensors up. And there's, as you said, like a ginormous amount of data coming through, and the plan is to scale up to like more than 10 countries.
14.
14, actually.
14 in 2 years. That's our plan.
Tell us a little bit
plan.
Like where the project is at and like, what excites you the most about it,
Yeah, I mean, so the project right now is that we've had conversations with the British Virgin Islands government and essentially sharing with them, the idea behind a nature-based economy that's independent of a tourism-based economy. How do we derive value from a healthy ecosystem? And a lot of that information, I lean on Blue Green Futures, which is run by a gentleman by the name of Ralph Chami, who has been at the IMF for over 25 years. He has done all the work to be able to identify what the carbon value of a whale is, what's the carbon value of one hectare of mangroves, and so on and so forth. So when you take all of those things, right, you have to measure them. It's great that you know what they're worth, and it's great that you've done this calculation, but how are they performing, right? We wouldn't want to invest in the stock market, in Apple or Microsoft or any of these companies, and never look at the performance of the index. We might say, yeah, I put some money in Microsoft and I disappeared. Maybe you do. Maybe that's your strategy, right? But most people would want to go into their portfolio and they would want to see how it was doing financially over a given period of time. Is it rising? Is it falling? If it's falling, why is it falling? Oh, there's some other things that are causing this particular thing to happen. Well, we think that we can do the same thing with environmental services, right? We call them ecosystem service values. So if you're looking at mangroves, if you're looking at seagrass, are they sequestering carbon? Are they sequestering what they were advertised? How do we know? Well, how would you know if you never measured it? And that's the fundamental difference, I think, in, when we look at traditional market of saying, well, we've got a verified carbon credit. Fantastic. How well is it performing? That's what every investor really wants to know. Where is the money going and is it doing it as advertised?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's so much depth and we could go into so many different examples, but I think just to, hone in on kind of what I see as the theme of this episode in our dialogue today, which is the nature-based economy. Like one thing that most people you know, probably underestimate is how much economy is left behind because we're just repeating kind of the same cycles over and over again. I remember you making the example of seagrass, right? Something I know very little about, to be super honest. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's a whole new economy to explore because there's so much value in this. Can you explain a little bit more about, you know, how you see kind of the evolution of our economy into more of a diversification that allows us to just leverage so much more value?
Yeah, no, sure. Well, for me, it began in a little place that I was told about. I've actually not been there, but Dr. Sylvia Earle told me about a place in 2016, excuse me, called Cabo Pulmo. Cabo Pulmo is in Mexico. It's in the Baja Peninsula. And, well, they had no fish. They'd been fished out. There were no sharks. There was no major predators. And it was a collective effort. Politicians, fishermen, locals. And they all said, you know what we need to do? Let's protect this area. No one comes in or out. No one fishes. It's protected. And so Sylvia proceeded to tell me that she dove the site 15 years later after it had been made a sanctuary. And she said, Jeremy, it was like the oceans I remember 50 years prior. 50. Now, that really got me thinking. I'm like, well, are you telling me that for a 15-year investment, I get a 50-year return? Right? Because that's really what we're talking about here. We're investing in sacrifice. Let's take a step back. Let's leave it alone. And when we take that sacrifice, of that investment sacrifice, we're paid back multiple times over. But how do you quantify this? The reason that we don't quantify it, or the issue of not being able to measure it and really understanding what those numbers are, well, we actually have a name for that. We call that the tragedy of the commons. It's a tragedy because we don't know what's in there and we don't know how we're affecting it, right? We don't really have any real science and real metrics. I mean, we do, right? But we don't. Not like in the traditional sense. So that became a huge inspiration for me. I realized what the work they did there at Mission Blue, making that a hope spot, it really made a difference. And I thought to myself, well, could we do this in the rest of the world? Is it possible that we could? My problem is that while you and I can talk about this stuff and we can talk, well, yeah, we need more fish. You say, yes, we need more fish. Okay, cool. And we'd be done. There'd be no problem. But not everybody thinks like this. And there might be people here saying, yeah, I really don't care if there's fish in the ocean or not. I like to eat tuna. Okay, well, awesome. I also think that it's a problem when there's one tuna fish left in the ocean and we're gonna kill it anyway because we like to eat tuna. But if we change that mindset and say, okay, well, right now we pull life out of the ocean and we derive value. But we are also having to fight climate change at the same time because we have to figure out, you know, whether you believe that anthropogenic climate change is real or not, it's still there, right? And we must do something. And I believe that, sure, we could make a machine that could pull carbon out of the atmosphere and it'll be very expensive. And it's probably only, you know, 2 to 10 years worth of science that made this thing possible. But we have a big machine on the planet that's worked for billions of years. The problem is that we always get in the way and we don't let it do its job. So you mentioned seagrass. Seagrass is really interesting because it can actually sequester up to 32 times the amount of carbon as, say, a rainforest in the same size could. That's really exciting, right? So, well, what's the problem? Well, you know, we have to go fishing and maybe we're dropping anchor and this and what, just the whole list of things can happen, right? But what if we said, okay, Microsoft, you've made a commitment to pay $1 billion to sequester all the carbon that exists, that you've put in the atmosphere since 1975. Good on you, right? That's a great way to lead the pack. But then you have to ask the question, well, where do you invest that $1 billion? Then you have to ask the question, of the $1 billion that you've invested, is it actually doing the thing that you think it's doing? How will you know? If you don't measure it, you'll never know. And so there are people that measure things like this all around the world. They do them for different reasons. And we thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool? I mean, we'll do some measurement, but wouldn't it be cool if we could financially incentivize people to kind of collect this data. Well, to do that, you would have to have a person to buy the data. And so one, you could easily say, well, an easy client would be carbon markets, right? They're selling the carbon markets. They want to verify that what they're selling is actually legit. That makes sense. So they're going to want to buy the data. But then governments are going to want to know, well, how healthy is our ecosystem? Is it producing? Are we doing something to harm it? Oh, there's a risk situation. Well, we want to make sure that we know what our risk profile is. So those people will buy this data. So it just keeps going on and on and on. Now what you've done is you've now associated a healthy ecosystem with something that's financially viable. And you might not believe in conservation. You might not believe in protecting the environment or even climate change. But there's no fooling the business side of this. And there is real intrinsic value in a healthy ecosystem without the extraction of life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, between you and I having this conversation, I think it's quite the opposite, right? It's like, I deeply believe in conservation. And I deeply believe that, you know, there's so much intrinsic value in nature, in just the perfection, that there's an interplay, as you said, for billions of years, that right. If we only understood it from a longevity perspective, and not through the filter of like a, you know, 70 to 100 year old human perspective, many things might be different. But, and this is kind of the, you know, cutthroat reality of the systems we've inherited on planet Earth, you know, the systems that are here are based on the language of finance, and that, you know, that can change. And I think it will change probably even within this lifetime, because there's just so much movement in all of these directions. But as we can quantify the true cost as well as the true value of the natural environment, it will become a no-brainer. And that's kind of, I mean, I think this is probably the best shot we have at just making it no second guess kind of direction, right? There's no like, oh, but what if this political party takes over? What if that person is in power? Or what about this country is not? No, if it matches the language of finance, because we've, as the people that do take actions for a healthy planet, we've understood that in the end of the day, almost everything gets reduced back to the language of finance. You know, probably unfortunately so, but it simply is the way that this world is currently run, at least at this point. And so if we are able to speak this language fluently, and we're able to create circumstances that make it, yeah, again, I'll use the word no-brainer, a no-brainer to support, a nature-based economy, then it will simply be so. And I think it's a big part of the pathway forward to a healthy planet.
I mean, I couldn't agree more, but, and I feel that sometimes when that conversation is like, well, unfortunately, it's the language of finance. Not unfortunately, that's the way that it is, like it or not. And it's, I don't think it will ever change. And here's the reason why. For us, you and I, to be talking about conservation of the oceans, we're coming from an enormous place of privilege. We can afford to have this conversation. But if I was a father of three and I had no money and every day I woke up, I had to figure out how to feed these kids, that is my mission. I don't care about the planet. I don't care about the ocean, because I simply don't have time to think about it, because I have got to figure out how to get money so that my children don't starve. This is a scenario that plays out over and over around the planet. Maybe not in the United States, maybe not in the UK, but maybe. Right.
Well, and so probably in those places too. Yeah.
But more so in other places where a lot of times the cameras don't go or the reporters don't go. We don't hear the stories, but it does happen. So how do we go back and say, okay, well, here's a way that we can inject some type of economic driver to be able to better understand our planet, to know exactly where we can actually, you know, use these resources the most effectively. This goes back to AI, right? It's like, there's no way that we could possibly parse this data on our own, but we've built tools to parse this data so that we can better understand and really at the end of the day, measure the impact. Now, I'm not suggesting everybody becomes like, you know, super wealthy and, you know, now they're riding around in like, you know, Mercedes or something. I don't know. But I think we have to think about, if I have enough to where I'm comfortable, right? And these are varying sliding scales around the world, various countries. If I have food, if I have a roof over my head, I have my basic necessities. And then I also want to do something good in my community, which also might have something to do with protecting the ocean or measuring something, then now I have that capability. And so I'm hoping that by saying, hey, locals that are in this particular area, if you're helping us with maintaining these buoys or whatever it is that we're using to measure, thank you for doing that. And here's some money that comes your way because you help contribute some data to the pool. That now becomes a potential revenue generator for some of these places that otherwise would be trying to figure out what other thing could they do with their time to put food on the table.
Funnily enough, that makes me think of plastic and all of the plastic pollution and the value that's in it once we tap into the value, right? There's a few projects out in the world that are working on how to turn plastic back into kind of petroleum-based, it's petroleum-based, so kind of into its original essence, so you can make fuel out of it. And so, there's so many ways how to get locals, no matter where in the world, involved into like a big cleanup mission. There's a quote on your website, Jeremy. I want to read it because I really like it. You're saying there's no Superman of the ocean, but there's a Justice League and each of us can stand up and do our part. That kind of reminds me of what you were just saying, right? Like, yeah, some people are right now just, heads over heels in the reality of life of needing to provide. And there's no shame in, drinking from plastic straws, even though, there's a massive campaign against plastic straws or into like showing up for our daily life. The point I'm trying to make is like, we can each do our part. And some of it is, I don't really think it goes back to shaming each other for the consumer choices we're making. I think that is like a complete distraction from the actual reality of how this planet is run. How do you kind of interpret your own quote there, like of the Justice League that there is for the natural environment?
Yeah, I mean, I say that because I feel like everybody has a superpower, right? And I think sometimes the ego gets the better of us. I mean, people have even said to me, they're like, hey, man, thanks for what you do. What does that mean? I mean, thank you for being nice to me, but like, I'm only doing what each of us equally should be doing. I'm not doing anything more or less. And I honestly, I would rather you not say that to me. I would rather you just roll up your sleeves and find a way to work with me. I look at this because I feel like, you might be like you have a podcast, right? So you're using your superpower, right? Somebody might have a podcast or they might have a massive tractor that floats and they can suck plastic out of the, I don't know, right? But everybody has something that they are really good at. And I've always felt like if everyone focused on what they were really good at, and was able to unite these efforts, then you would be the Justice League. The only reason why the Justice League is powerful is because they're united in their actions, right? If every one of them said, no, I'm the Superman, yeah. Well, there would be no Justice League and there would be no good things that happen, right? And so I think when we look at the threats that we face on the planet and we think of poverty, you think of climate change, yeah, those are big problems, but they're not as big as polarization. They're not as big as us not being able to unify, because I don't care who you are. I don't care, what if you listen to this right now and you're fuming mad because you disagree with me. I'm sorry, but at the end of the day, we're sitting on a blue marble pummeling through space, and whether you love me or hate me, we have the same problems, and it's in both of our best interests to just find a way to work together and utilize those superpowers for good.
Yeah, we're really in this together. I don't think people are listening and like fuming at you though, Jeremy. I think it's quite the opposite.
But you never know. There could be one guy out there.
And then please write us so we can learn from your perspective.
Yeah, the guy with the red glasses.
but there is a question that I want to ask you about younger generations, because I what I'm hearing you say, this is me kind of interpreting a little bit into what you're saying, is you used your frustration and your like kind of big question mark over your head about why the world is the way it is into just saying, I'm going to just do what I can do, right? And I remember you actually telling me that story the first time you were on in a bit of a more elaborate way. And similar to me, when I started this podcast, I was just so massively frustrated that anywhere you tuned on media, news, whatever it is, it's either about completely mindless things that just distract us more so our attention spans are decreasing, or it's like, watch out, the world's gonna burn 1 year sooner than we thought, and
right.
Like, this can't be it. Like, there must be amazing people out there doing amazing things every single day, and guess what, there are. And so I would love to hear what you'd have to say to 15 to 25-year-olds right now that are somewhere between depressed, lost, and frustrated about the world that they've inherited. Because, you know, I'm 35 now, and I remember that 20 years ago. I was like, this is really the way you all have chosen to run this earth? Like, you all know this makes no sense, right? And most adults are like, well, it's just the way it is, Julian. And I was like, huh, how are we all just surrendering to this is just the way it is? So like, what's your advice to someone who's, you know, of a younger generation who's like, ah, oh, where do I even start? Like, how do I unpack my superpower?
Right, right. Well, it was like Alice in Wonderland. Start at the beginning and end at the end. now, that's the ultimate advice. But I think the thing that you must realize that's probably the most important here is that we are at a point in time in human history, unlike any other humans that have ever walked this planet, to understand our natural environment. We understand our bodies in a way that we've never understood before. We have technology that is unprecedented. Never in a time in human history have we had technology where we could, you know, have this. Like, we're having a video conversation. Like, even when I was a kid in school, we dreamed of this. It was a cartoon called The Jetsons, and everything that we thought would be possible has become possible. And so now take all of that, right? And think of what I just said in that last sentence. Everything that we thought was possible has become possible. Nothing is going to be possible until you first set the target to make it possible. Nelson Mandela has said something to the tune of like, it is impossible until the first person does it, right? So what we're facing right now is an impossible challenge. It's impossible because, well, no one's really stepped up in a way that could solve this from a total global unification. And that's really what we need. So where do you start with that? Well, you start with being honest with yourself and saying, well, what speaks to you? What motivates you? You know, are you passionate about the ocean? Are you passionate about prairie land? Are you passionate about biodiversity, carbon sequestration? I mean, I don't know. There could be a lot of things. And then you start finding groups of people around you that are better at things than you are. And I say that because if you surround yourself with people who can do the things that you do, there's redundancies, right? And you'll find really quickly, like I always say to everybody, it's like, you know, I want to be the dumbest guy in the room, right? I want to surround my team is way smarter than me, and that's the way it should be, right? It does a couple things. One, it inspires me to break the boundaries of what I think is possible for me personally, but collectively we also try to break the boundaries, and that team ultimately starts growing. Well, that team could just be a group of friends. A couple years ago, we started something on Necker called Gen C. You can go to joingenc.org right now, and you can see this website, and you can create an account. You can fill out your profile, and you can say the things that you like to do as a youth, you know, or just an old guy like me. And where do you live? And this will help you join up with other different people that are within your area that are also focused on these issues. And so this was started by myself, Philippe Cousteau, and Laura Clark, who is the co-founder of the Palau Pledge. These are really amazing tools that we have. And this goes back to that technology thing. We have these things that we can actually do. But I think sometimes the danger is that we decide that, well, we'll just watch Facebook instead, or we'll just watch YouTube. And we end up kind of in that role where we're just collecting information. But there's so much in those heads. If you're listening to this podcast now and you're saying, oh, I want to do something, I just don't know what. The first thing to do is to join up with a group of people who, you know, are capable of helping you. Take you to the next level and be honest about your weaknesses. You know, if you're horrible at bookkeeping, tell people that. Tell people that's what you want to get better at. All of those kinds of things start to build a community. And I've seen it happen. We've seen it happen at Ultramarine. You know, we've had people come to the island that had no idea why they were there, what they were doing. And really beautiful collaborations came out of nowhere. So that's a really long way of me just saying, go find some friends.
Follow your passion. But it is actually, such a massively important advice, because I think everyone, me included, has those days where you're like, man, what did I even do today? Or, you know, you watch the same movie you've watched five times before, or watch the same sport you've watched before, or, you know, Netflix or whatever it is, and or YouTube these days too. You know, you can get lost in the YouTube algorithm real easy, right? It's like 5 hours later, yeah, you're like, I know what just happened?
That happens to me. That's why I specifically mentioned it.
Yeah, and I know a few friends who are like, man, I'm addicted to YouTube. And I'm like, how does that even work? But the point is that we have to, you know, become accountable to who we are and how we spend our time on the planet. Because, like, yeah, there is a timeline in which we're all sucked into a big robotic dopamine machine that just, like, sucks us dry, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's really going to happen, but it's a possibility because, like, yeah, we've built all these tools, but really it just takes a little bit of self-control and really good friends that, you know, pull you up again and say, hey, what are you doing today? What do we create today? And it's very interesting that you mentioned join Gen Z, which for me is a German native, by the way, still really hard to hear the difference between Gen Z and Gen C.
We did that on purpose because Gen Z, right? We all know what that is, but there is only one generation. There's Gen C, SEA, where we're all part of that generation.
Perfect. And I'm really grateful we're spelling this one out. You know, because I just pulled it up here on my second screen, and you know, it's those kind of initiatives. And I think it's often very interesting that when, you know, when you find passionate young people in their teenage years, they have this attitude very often that adults seem to forget. This idea of like, nope, I am passionate about it. Let's go. There's no limit. I am here to do this, right? There's no resistance in the mind yet. That's like, well, but I only have so much time. I also got to do my regular job. I'm also responsible for this, this, and that. And so there's like limitation already to what becomes possible, right? And so the Mandela quote you mentioned, like, it always seems impossible until it's done.
Yeah.
That's often embodied.
Actually the quote, by the way. I messed it up.
That's okay. There's a few of those quotes on, like, I think Mandela has one of them. And then there's Albert Einstein, you know, like, can't solve problems with consciousness. Like, you know, that people always butcher, but we all know what we mean. Yeah. Is like, we have to rise up and believe in things to be possible. We have to rise up and actually to a different perspective, a different filter, a different worldview, different paradigm, different mindset. Because otherwise, yeah, we could just be drowned by our problems. But I think that is literally the human journey, is to rise up, you know, to take that deep breath again, come fully into the now moment and be like, huh, what am I going to do today? And I think that's how the Ocean Summit started, no? Like, it wasn't that you were like best friends with Richard Branson and you're like, what shall we do?
I didn't know him.
Yeah, you were just, I'm so passionate about this and how can I get activated?
No, literally like that. I know it sounds lofty. Be like, oh yeah, we're going to go do a summit on Richard Branson's island. Like, yeah, when I hear that, it sounds like, whoa, it's far out, right? Like, I still don't believe it. But it didn't start that way. It literally started me telling everybody. Like, when I said earlier, when you have a weakness, you can't balance a checkbook or something, like, tell people that. Like, somebody will come out of nowhere and be like, I will help you with this. Just please stop talking about it. and that's what happened. I was like, you know, I would be really great to put people together. And, you know, I saw what was I saw how the Carbon War Room was built and the elders. And I was like, yeah, Necker seems like a great place to do this. And my friend Susanna Barla said to me, she's like, hey, do you know Susie Mai? And I said, no, I don't know her. She's like, you must meet her. She does events on Necker all the time. And I know that she's passionate about the ocean. I should put the two of you together. And so Susanna, who's one of my crazy friends, she's always got something. I mean, she's always got something really cool happening. And she's just one of the most wild personalities that you'll ever meet. And so if she says to go meet somebody, I will always say yes, because, you know, she just knows how to connect people. So Susie and I talk and we get along brilliantly that first call. And then she said to me, she's like, you know, I'm really tired on my end. I'm an athlete and I'm tired of people saying things, they want to do things for the oceans or for the environment, but then they just fall short on the action. I said, yeah, me too. Like, what if we had an action summit, like an ocean action summit? And she's like, yeah. So we actually, the first year we called it the Ocean Summit. And then we realized it was kind of too generic. So we renamed it to Ultramarine, right? Because it was like the deepest, most blue that you could possibly find on planet Earth. So it became Ultramarine Ocean Action Summit. And, you know, I did get a chance to go meet with Richard before it and pitch him on the idea. And, you know, it wasn't the most idealistic way to pitch somebody. First of all, don't ever pitch somebody when they're eating. That's my rule. I hate that, right? But that's just what happened. He was eating breakfast and they're like, yeah, come on over. And he's so laid back. He's eating, you know, he's just got back from kite surfing. So he's just wearing his swim shorts and no shirt and eating his breakfast. And I'm like, this is not what I wanted to do. So what's the idea? What is it you want to do? And I said, well, you know, we were talking about bringing artists, philanthropists, business leaders, politicians, scientists, and, you know, getting them to collaborate by saying, you know, what if we focused on how do we protect 30% of the world's oceans, but we held everybody accountable for their commitments in 12-month rolling cycles. That way we would actually have some progress to 30 by 30. And, you know, that was the idea. And he goes, I think that's a brilliant idea. You want to do it here on NECA? And I was like, yeah, I would love to. So so that's what we did, you know, and he's always been a real good, I don't know, like a challenger. Like he'll sit there when we have our panels and he'll write in his notebook and then he'll raise his hand and he'll ask a question. Have you thought about this? Or how does this work? And it's really great because a lot of times, you know, I didn't really expect him to be so engaged and he really has helped. First of all, he's helped me personally just think about things that I haven't really thought of before. And I think the same is true with others. But I also say that like this event is can happen anywhere in the world. It doesn't have to have Richard there. We're just grateful that he likes to show up. But I think that a lot of times people will show up and there's this kind of like, they don't know really how to kind of interact and they don't know who's there. They don't know the full story, but then really quickly they realize that everybody is just like there to help, you know? So, you know, that all of that really happened to me as a side effect of what I was trying to do with Ocean Currency Network. Cause there were people there that I might not necessarily work with, but I do feel like they needed to share and work with some of these other people.
You know, and the story, and thank you so much for sharing that story, including the like breakfast pitch, which, yeah, you're right. It's kind of like a suboptimal moment to share.
Never. It's totally against the rule.
Right. It's against the rule. But it kind of proves the point of the point you were making of just talk about it, put yourself out there, get activated. Right. Because, yeah, if you didn't do it in that moment, you might have never gotten that chance again. And you're right. In theory, you don't need Necker Island or Richard Branson for this kind of a summit. But in reality, that's how it happened, right? And so for the next person, this is kind of like a weird symptom of our society, right? There's like, oh, if I only could meet a billionaire or a famous person to help me. Like, that's not what it's about at all. It's about following the synchronicities and following that flow until, you know, whatever lucky circumstances you need for your project happen to occur. And you cannot really plan for that. You can only live it. And this is what really differentiates people that are action takers for a healthy planet or action takers for anything that is a creative idea to those of us that, you know, kind of dream about it, have the plan, you know, maybe write it down in their notebook, but then rather go and watch YouTube again, right? That's the main difference is you have to go out there and you have to put yourself out there. And I love your addition to that, Jeremy, which is like, definitely talk about what you're not good at either as well, right? Because really, like, it's the hardest thing to admit I'm not good at this, but that's what makes us human, and we all are imperfectly perfect with all the flaws we have, and so we need each other. That's the whole gist of it, of the superhero team, right?
Yeah, but I promise you, the more you talk about what you're not good at, all of a sudden you're going to be really good at it.
Yeah, I don't know if that would go for me in bookkeeping, but I hear you.
No, I guarantee you, if you really said, I'm not good at this, and you told everybody that, somebody would sit you down and you would be a professor of bookkeeping. Mark my words.
Well, let's see if we can go one level deeper on that, because what I'm really hearing you say, and that's the Justice League for the ocean, but it's the big metaphor, is like, we're Team Earth together. Sure, there might be some players that still would prefer to play like an extractive game, but it seems like there's more and more, you know, there are more and more people coming online to this. Well, we're on the same team, so how can we really support each other? Not just, right. I wish we could collaborate, because that's like an often said sentence, right? But it's this synergistic process, which I deeply believe is the superpower of our species. And it is the superpower that has to do with us being in alignment with what I would call actual regeneration with the principle of biology that runs this planet, right? All of nature around us that we're a part of, think of the forest, think of the mycelium, it is a synergistic process of life. And so we as humans, we can opt out of that by pursuing the journey of the separate individual, which is like, you know, the glory of, you know, the American dream in a certain way. It's like, get rich by going there on this specific path. But really, once we opt back into the natural pathway that's laid out for us, I don't believe there's any challenge, as you said earlier, that we can't solve.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, our history of adaption and ingenuity always rings true at the end of the day. You just have to apply yourself. And the thing I worry about the most is the people that have the capability of doing something amazing that don't apply themselves because they don't feel, you know, like it feels like such a big problem that they don't know where to start. I mean, I get it. Like I have dyslexia and I probably have ADHD, just never diagnosed, but I have a problem sometimes when I see something so big, where do I even start? And you know, for me, it was always like when I was a kid, it was like, you know, I couldn't clean my own room. I would make such a mess and I wouldn't know where to start. I literally would not know where to start. I would always get in trouble. And one day my mom said, okay, first things, pick up your clothes, take the dirty ones, put them in the hamper, take the clean ones, fold them, put them in the drawer. Okay, next, pick up the Legos. And then she just went down the list. Amazingly, that worked for me. And today, this very day, I have a notebook that I write in and I have multiple notebooks. And I will go in there and I'll make a list and I will mark off the things that I need to do. And now I have digital versions of that that help me. But ultimately, you know, I think sometimes, you know, imagine, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, okay, I'm ready to do something. Now envision yourself, you know, 85 years old. And a little boy or a little girl comes up to you and asks you to tell them a story. What story are you going to tell them? Are you going to tell them how you went to work and you created a lot of revenue for your company? Or are you going to go and tell them a story that, hey, look, you know, one time I went to the Amazon and I found a crocodile and I realized that they're endangered and I wanted to save them. And so this is what we did. Like, think about those kinds of things. If you don't do anything for anybody else, think of that little boy or that little girl when you're 85 years old, could be your granddaughter or grandson. And your job now is to tell them all the wonderful things because you know that that story is going to inspire them to go do something. So you have the rest of your life to get somebody, that little person inspired. So get busy.
And it starts with picking up the Legos.
That's it. That's it. No parent wants to step on that.
I love it, Jeremy. Thank you so much for your time once again and, you know, sharing both your stories. As you said, we're all storytellers, so we really, that's what inspires us, right? It's the stories we get to hear from others and that show us, like, success looks many different ways along the journey. Afterwards, it's always easy to make anything sound heroic or fabulous.
Of course.
The process of it, the process of moving from a consumer of reality into a participant of creating and co-creating a world that does work for everyone. I think that's what's so exciting about this time and being alive in this time is we're invited, all of you listening, you're invited to become a participant in co-creating a reality rather than just, you know, continuing to watch the same stuff.
That's why I'm so keen on the nature-based economies and artificial intelligence, because I'm telling you that this is exactly what the internet boom was, but like times 100,000. And there's an opportunity for us to do it the right way. And it's a huge space. You know, there's going to be a lot of room for innovators. So get in there, get your hands dirty, roll up your sleeves. Let's go.
Let's go.